papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smucker.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on newsroom decision making. Some thought-provoking conversation, we hope, among some veteran journalists in upstate New York, taking a look at what's happening locally, nationally, and on our state. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, and now publishing the Upstate American on Substack. And I'm here with Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, what's on your mind?
Man, it's always a tough week for media coverage, isn't it? I mean, it seems like we never run out of really important topics to talk about. And this week, man, what's happening in Minneapolis and how the press covered it has been really interesting, to say the least.
I think you're right. And that is really, I'd say, topic one. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. And on your mind?
Still Minneapolis. I think we need to stay on that topic. And one of the angles that I'd like to take is the fact that journalists are being advised on how they ought to be covering these things and how they have to be able to protect themselves. So citizens are being advised about it, and so are journalists.
You know, I think you have an important point there, and this is where I'd like to begin as well, because I actually have a sense of hope, which is something rare on this program where we talk about the decline of the news media ecosystem. We know that that decline is real, that the challenge of the digital revolution has created a financial Donnybrook for most of the media, you know, even those that are supported by contributions like public media. And of course, public radio and television have lost their taxpayer support. But in the midst of this decline, in the midst of the challenges that are confronting us, I think there is hope in what we saw from Minneapolis in the combination of solid and powerful reporting by media organizations with local citizens actually functioning as citizen journalists. Remember, it was the use of video, of cell phone videos, that recorded both of the homicides by federal agents in the streets of Minneapolis. Both Renee Good and Alex Preddy we saw over and over again this violence. And if we hadn't had those citizens on the street with their phones, we wouldn't have seen that. And I kind of think this could be a watershed moment in so many ways. But for the media, it could be that this will begin to show citizens the power they have as storytellers, as people who record what is really happening. And when you combine that with, although a smaller yet still vibrant network of professional journalists, hopefully with some of the fine regional news organizations like the Minnesota Star Tribune and the national organizations like the New York Times, I think you could have a way for journalism to go forward, both sort of the volunteer and the professional side of things together. Am I being too much of a Pollyanna here?
Well, I think what you're saying is absolutely true, but there are dangers involved, so that the citizens and the journalists alike need to weigh the risks involved to themselves, to their own safety in doing it. You know, when you think back to George Floyd and the video that was taken of the police standing on his neck and ultimately killing him, it wasn't a protester using their video. It was just an ordinary citizen who pulled out their cell phone. And by that action, she could say that she became a citizen journalist, you know, telling the story. In Minneapolis now, it's going to be protesters generally. and they are citizen journalists. But there are rules that both they and the ordinary citizens with their cell phones need to follow for their protection, not that it even guarantees their protection.
You know, this may be a technical point, but I was quite taken by the fact that Alex Preti was shooting horizontally, which is what people are encouraging journalists to do, is shoot horizontally. For the longest time, we shot vertically. It just makes for better video if you do it horizontally. But kudos to the networks that I was listening to and watching. They were taking care to vet the video before they would air it. And then they were giving the warnings that, you know, this is graphic content. Because I think to watch someone be shot to death and then to have the body shot a number of times as it's lying in the street, that's upsetting. So I thought they did a very good job of at least vetting things and before they aired them. Because I could find all of these videos online probably an hour before the networks would air them. And I was wondering, is this real? Is this not real? They have a process by which they find out whether these things are truly happening. I was a little concerned that it took them so long to call a lie a lie. There was so much of these seem to be contradicting what the Department of Homeland Security are saying. It took far too long for them to get rid of the seam, or this appears to be in direct conflict, when our eyes told us it was conflicting. I mean, there was no doubt about it. So I think they erred too much in the side of objectivity in that respect, and it was infuriating for anyone who was actually watching the videos.
Well, it wasn't objectivity. It was erring on the side of playing it safe instead of saying what is.
You know, it does bring to mind this notion of citizens in the street doing the work of reporters when there just aren't enough reporters to go around. It does bring to mind the notion of sort of the auxiliary police. You know, I remember when I was a young reporter in the suburbs, there were citizens who were trained to help direct traffic in an emergency when there was a storm, that kind of thing. And we talked about when we first started facing significant newsroom cuts as a result of the digital revolution, we talked about the need to perhaps create a citizen journalism core, to have some training sessions so that we could equip people in the community to do some of the work that reporters might have if you still had as many dozens of reporters as once used to work for these news organizations. And I think you combine that thought with what Barbara was just saying about guidelines for safely covering what's going on, maybe with some training, maybe with some formalization of the roles of these citizens who could become citizen journalists, we might see a way forward to actually cover some of the neighborhoods that have now fallen off the coverage capacity as news organizations have been challenged.
But as you can see, there's also whether they're journalists already working for media companies or citizen journalists, that they are at risk. And although they might be following the law, they still could be attacked by an ICE agent. On the flip side, whether you're a journalist or a citizen, and journalists are citizen, I hasten to add, that you can't be interfering with the work of the quote-unquote law enforcement people. You're not allowed to do that, and you're supposed to obey their commands by and large. And you can object to some of that, but there are things that you have to assess the risk of not following their directions. And the Indivisible program, the Indivisible organization, had a seminar the other night where they were advising people, and these were things that would apply to, you know, journalists and citizens about, you know, how to cover this safely. And one of the things was what Judy mentioned about don't edit your video, have an extra camera, take pictures of everything around you. So, and these are things that journalists should be trained to, so that you've got the landmarks, stand far enough back so that if the officers have to approach you, and you can, and then
stay an arm length away for sure.
Probably more than that, where you can be videotaping that they are walking toward you, and you need to narrate that as it's happening, and also get pictures horizontally is good. Everybody else around you, like who else is taking pictures so that you can find them possibly later for more angles for your story.
It's really good. That's actually the way you're saying that a journalist should be trained to take establishing shots. You know, if you've ever studied videography, get your establishing shots, your long shots, and the full environment. It's really good. Indivisible, just by way of explaining to people who may not know, is the organization that sponsors the No Kings rallies across the country. And they have chapters all over. And so that kind of training is important for them, but it is really useful. You think, Judy, this might work for journalists as well?
You know, we and when I was at the New York Press Association, we did do some citizen journalist training. People would sit in on these courses where we talked about ethics and we talked about, but this was more print and less photo oriented, but there was real interest in it. And because nearly everybody has a phone now that can take video and take still images, it seems like it's more than a good idea to capture or to make use of that resource, especially in a case like Minneapolis. I can only imagine the amount of video being generated in that community.
Yes.
And a good idea would be to have a central repository where we could see it all, but there is nothing like that.
Well, that would be a good task for the Minnesota Star Tribune or the St. Paul Pioneer Press, you know, to be a part of that place where you people upload their video so that they can make some use of it. That's a really good thought. You know, as a former leader of a unionized newsroom, I know that there are some issues there. You would have to get the union to agree to have content produced by ordinary citizens. And there is, of course, the liability that your lawyers will remind you of. If you are commissioning ordinary citizens to do some journalistic work, you're going to have to be aware of your responsibility to them and to somewhat protect them.
So Pollyanna has become a wet blanket now.
Well, you know that if police ask a journalist or tell them to turn over their equipment, or if they seize your equipment, you as a journalist can say, hey, you've got the Fourth Amendment protects me from unreasonable searches and seizures. Or you can say, this is my company's equipment. It's not mine. It doesn't mean that they're not going to take it, stomp on it, or, you know, take it away from you and use it against you in some way. So there's issues like that that wouldn't have normally come up in the past that need to be thought about.
You know, it's interesting that the Poynter Institute, which we've talked about often in this program, which is a training center and think tank for journalists based in St. Petersburg, Florida, has reissued some safety guidelines for journalists that they first published in 2021 after the Trump mob that attacked the U.S. Capitol. And, you know, some of it is very sensible stuff, notably this, that the attitude is important. You know, a journalist is going to be respectful of police officers, is going to not argue when tensions are high, and they're going to try to avoid being mistaken for a demonstrator. So that is different from a demonstrator themselves. That doesn't always protect journalists, but attitude matters, and also trying not to identify yourself necessarily. Don't draw attention to yourself, I should say. You're not trying to pretend that you're not who you are. But a journalist understands to kind of be less intrusive and to keep the camera rolling, to be aware of that you're recording everything.
Because they're being perceived by the people whom they're recording as the enemy.
Yeah, I've seen images from Minnesota of clearly identifiable reporters, especially photographers, on the ground being tackled by ICE agents or sitting there who have been sprayed in the face with some sort of irritant. I mean, sometimes it doesn't matter if you've done what you should do. You know, we worked for local newspapers where our photographers and our journalists typically had a good relationship with the local police force and knew when they arrived at a scene what they could cover and what they couldn't. Often they got really good access to an important scene, a fire, an accident, a protest. Those kind of relationships are non-existent when it comes to, you know, what's happening with immigration enforcement.
That advice coming from the organization with the 25 tips has things that you would have thought would be unthinkable that we'd even have to worry about as journalists. You know, the basic first aid skills and be prepared to deal with being sprayed with pepper spray and what you do about that, and having the phone numbers on your arm of the company's attorney, and having some energy bars with you in case you're thrown into jail with no food.
It is interesting how differently we have to approach things now in this situation. I was in El Salvador briefly during the Civil War there, and in the car that I traveled in, we used masking tape to put the big letters TV on the side of the car. Not that I was a TV reporter, but people who wouldn't understand the word journalist would respect that. That is, both sides in the combat there didn't want to attack journalists because they wanted the stories, their stories, to be told. It's striking that that's not the case in America even anymore, that identifying as a journalist doesn't, in fact, protect you. As Poynter points out, under the Privacy Protection Act, which is a federal law, you actually can say, I'm a journalist. My equipment here belongs to my company, and if you want it, you say to the cop, if you want to access it, you first need to contact the attorney.
Well, thank you for telling me, sir.
Yeah, right. Yes, you're not going to get respect from ICE or the Border Patrol for that kind of language.
As these enforcement operations, go into other states like Maine, what we're seeing up from Maine now are citizens who are filing report or video of people being taken into custody in Maine. They still have a few small newspapers, but they don't have the robust local news coverage that they once did. And you're not seeing the national media so focused on Minnesota, they haven't really shifted yet to Maine. And there are things like this happening in every state. As we sit here in our Albany studio, we really don't know what's happening out in our own lands because it's so dispersed. And unless there's someone who's actually bearing witness to it and posting a video, we're not going to know about it.
Right. I was trying to go back to the good old days when they could just pick people off the streets quietly and not going to have any fuss.
None would be the wiser. Well, in any case, the notion of the combination of bystander video and newsroom analysis really undercut the White House narrative on what's going on and has resulted now in what seems to be the first steps toward a change of approach. We'll see how that turns out. If you're just joining us, it's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith here with Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo. We have some listeners who have written in. We're always glad to hear from our listeners. Here's one writing in from Seattle. Thank you, Linda.
Seattle, Washington?
That's right. Just got introduced via KBCS. Listening from Seattle, who says, a journalist on labor issues who really wrote that during working for a socialist quarterly while working a job that paid enabled her to write her truth as she saw it. And she says, seeing today, I can only imagine the pressure journalists are under to self-censor. Makes me glad I didn't pursue a career in mainstream media, but your program gives some spotlight to this dynamic. Keep up the great work and the exposure to press coverage. Thank you, Linda, for writing in. We have a listener in Northampton, Jonathan, saying, I too would welcome more conservative right-wing voices. I think this might not be aimed at us, but would also welcome some actual left-wing voices, not just some lefty liberal voices that are weak tea in terms of left politics, I think. Yeah, that's probably aimed for the morning show.
Yeah. We might just want to pass it on to them and
let
cut
them
that
do
out.
That, right. And here we have a response from Matt and Cindy responding to our story about the FCC, saying that late night shows may need to be balanced. Matt and Cindy writing to say, what about Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson et al.? How could they possibly ignore that Hannity is in direct contact with Trump and say that Kimmel and his like are biased and Fox is not? Hypocrisy apparently has no bounds when you have the Supreme Court of the United States on your side.
So it wouldn't affect Tucker because he is a podcast, so he is not under FCC rules. This would apply only to programs that are aired or use the federal airwaves. A purely cable show probably wouldn't be under that as well. So it's just those over-the-air broadcasts that, even though a lot of people are just watching things streaming, the fact that they're over-the-air puts them under the control of the Federal Communications Commission.
It is interesting, by the way, speaking of Fox, that 20 minutes after Fox News said that Tom Holman, the border czar, should be sent to Minnesota, Donald Trump did that. We know how much Donald Trump is watching Fox News, right?
The press report said that, he was stuck in Washington over the weekend because he had to go to Melania's documentary screen or something on Sunday. So he was watching the news and he was mostly focused on Fox, but it was when he flipped to the other channels and saw what was being said and how that coverage was proceeding that he started to have doubts as well. So don't let them fool you. I think he's not a pure Fox watcher.
Oh, notwithstanding the fact that he's old enough to be a pure Fox watcher.
I had some doubts about how that's being reported. I wouldn't be surprised if he had already had those kinds of discussions and that, was it Fox that aired that they are getting the scoop on what he is about to do. They're reporting it ahead of him, but that makes them look good. And
the feedback loop. It is sort of a virtuous cycle.
That's what I think happened.
Yeah, probably so. While we're talking about networks and their
direction. Oh, I know where we're going, aren't we?
Here we are. CBS News, folks. Barry Weiss, editor-in-chief now of CBS News. What do we call Barry Weiss? A commentator, anyway, who is Trump-friendly. And now she's announced and presented to her team, CBS News, what her plan is. And it seems to be that it's going to make CBS News look a little bit more like the Free Press, the organ that they paid her $150 million for, to replace journalists with sort of influencers and podcast types, more commentary, less reporting.
I would be banging my head on the microphone if I didn't know that it was going to drive David Gustino crazy when he came to edit the show. But what we say again and again on this show is that programs need to have real reporters talking about real facts and get rid of all these commentators. And Barry Weiss is doing just the opposite. I'm about ready to give up on CBS as a credible news organization.
So CBS, her role, her charge is to make that a successful business. And by successful means money making, not successful in terms of truth telling or deep news reporting or any of that. And looking at that from that perspective, if she is coming up with ways that will make it a money-making success, the response from everyone else has to be to go elsewhere for news.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's going to happen. I can't see how this is going to reverse the slide of CBS News unless she's just intending to say, we will compete against Fox for people who look for commentary rather than for news. You think that's possible?
I think that's the business model. And, you know, Tony DiCoppo, the new anchor of the CBS Evening News, is getting a little bit of flack this week because after Barry Weiss says, we're going to go after all the hard-hitting scoops, what does he do? He interviews his grandmother on a story about grandmothers caring for children. It seems like, sure, there's always a place for a little bit of soft news in the story, but if you're going to ignore the anniversary of the January 6th Capitol insurrection and focus on a puff piece on Marco Rubio, you've lost a little bit of credibility. No, not a little bit. A lot.
No knock on grandma.
No knock on grandma, yeah. She got her moment in the spotlight.
It is amazing. 18 paid commentators being hired now by CBS News, including H.R. McMaster, who was national security advisor to Donald Trump, the president of the Manhattan Institute, a conservative organization here in the state of New York, and conservative historian Neil Ferguson.
I'm remembering Eric Severide, you know?
Yeah.
Those were the days.
We're dating
ourselves here.
And in the evolution of various media, let us note the launch of a new newspaper, sort of. The California Post has launched a new tabloid newspaper. The Associated Press refers to it as a brash, cheeky, and conservative-friendly fixture of the Big Apple. Well, that is the New York Post, bringing that to the West Coast. Any predictions about the future of the California Post?
Well, they'll have a lot of snappy, funny headlines.
Yes.
And maybe they'll have a good back-of-the-paper sports section, like the New York Post
does.
You
know, I give it 6 months.
You think?
Los Angeles is not New York City. The two totally different audiences out there. And the idea that they think they can replicate their success in New York, I think they're foolish to think so.
Well, it can't be a tabloid print play. You know, in New York, you still have people commuting on subways. There still is some value to a print tabloid product, even if those are the Daily News and the Post are diminished. So what they're trying to do, obviously, is create something that will get some visibility digitally with plays like, of course, we all remember that wonderful headline from the early 80s, Headless Body and Topless Bar. You know, they just don't get a chance to do that.
We all journalists remember that.
You know, I think TMZ has got the market out in California.
You're right.
I mean, nobody does Page Six quality news like TMZ does. And when it comes to Hollywood and the California scene, I just think they've got an old model and they're taking it to a new place. And they may last for a little bit of time, but they're not going to last long.
And finally, Barbara, you said you wanted to talk about this rise of another media chain. This one is called Carpenter Media, which now is, I think, the fourth largest chain of newspapers in the United States. And they've bought all these community newspapers, and they're applying standards to them that are
not really newspaper standards. That's part of the problem. And there was a story about a reporter who had the unpleasant discovery that people complained. The people who were criticized in a story complained to the owners. And then the owners went ahead without consulting with the local management. They wouldn't talk to the reporter, but they would at least be talking to their top editor, you would think, or the publisher. And they just pulled the story. First, they changed the story, and then they pulled the story, and this is problematic.
To put it mildly, I think it underscores the importance of who owns a newspaper, because this is what we're seeing at the Washington Post these days, where one of the wealthiest men in the world is deciding, apparently, that he's going to make further cuts in this storied newspaper, and it's decimating it. So if the person who owns the paper ultimately doesn't have a backbone or doesn't care about journalistic ethics, you're lost.
Yeah, and it's not just the person. And, you know, in the case of Alden Capital, I remember that we had an edict at our papers to not mention the company in any kind of a story without first running that through the ownership.
I know we're out of time almost, but can I just say that for Washington Post, their problem is of their own making or of Jeff Bezos' own making. They had a flight of subscribers because of their dramatic change in the opinion section. And as a result, the news side is being suffered. I mean, I imagine that decline to only continue unless they turn things around. And I don't see that happening.
Ownership matters. All right, we are out of time for this edition of The Media Project. That was Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and I'm Rex Smith. And we hope you'll join us again next week on The Media Project. Thanks to our producer, David Gustina, for making this all happen. We'll see you next week.
She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk, hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspaper men meet such interesting people.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
When they know they've got a people's fight to wage, ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build, meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people, it's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people, their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.